Chapter 4. How Gritty Are You? I recently gave a lecture on grit to undergraduates at the Wharton School of Business. Even before I'd cleared my notes from the podium, an aspiring entrepreneur rushed to introduce himself. He was charming, full of the energy and enthusiasm that makes teaching young people so rewarding. Breathlessly, he told me a story meant to illustrate his own prodigious grit. Earlier that year, he'd raised thousands of dollars for his startup, going to heroic lengths to do so and pulling several all-nighters in the process. I was impressed and said so, but I hastened to add that grit is more about stamina than intensity. So if you're working on that project with the same energy in a year or two, email me, I said. I can say more about your grit then. He was puzzled. Well, I might not be working on the same thing in a few years. Good point. Lots of ventures that seem promising at the start turn out badly. Lots of optimistic business plans end up in the discard bin. Okay, I said, so maybe this particular startup won't be what you're working on. But if you're not working in the same industry, if you're onto some totally unrelated pursuit, then I'm not sure your story illustrates grit. You mean stay in one company? He asked. Not necessarily, but skipping around from one kind of pursuit to another, from one skill set to an entirely different one, that's not what gritty people do. But what if I move around a lot and, while I'm doing that, I'm working incredibly hard? Grit isn't just working incredibly hard. That's only part of it. Pause. Why? He asked. Well, for one thing, there are no shortcuts to excellence, I explained. Developing real expertise, figuring out really hard problems, it all takes time, longer than most people imagine. And then, you know, you've got to apply those skills and produce goods or services that are valuable to people. Rome wasn't built in a day. He was listening, so I continued. And here's the really important thing. Grit is about working on something you care about so much that you're willing to stay loyal to it. It's doing what you love, he said. I get that. Right. It's doing what you love, but not just falling in love, staying in love. How gritty are you? Let's go through a version of the grit scale I developed from my study at West Point, and which I used in other studies described in this book. You can find the grit scale on the PDF included with this audiobook or on my website at angeladuckworth.com. I'll read each of the items in order. Don't overthink these questions. Instead, just ask yourself how you compare, not just to your coworkers, friends, or family, but to most people. Here we go. Number one, new ideas and projects sometimes distract me from previous ones. Number two, setbacks don't discourage me. I don't give up easily. Number three, I often set a goal, but later choose to pursue a different one. Four, I am a hard worker. Five, I have difficulty maintaining my focus on projects that take more than a few months to complete. Six, I finish whatever I begin. Seven, my interests change from year to year. Eight, I am diligent. I never give up. 9. I have been obsessed with a certain idea or project for a short time, but later lost interest. 10. I have overcome setbacks to conquer an important challenge. When calculating your grit score, you add up all your points and divide by 10. The maximum score on this scale is 5, extremely gritty, and the lowest possible score is 1, not at all gritty. On the PDF included with this audiobook, you can view a chart to see how your scores compare to a large sample of American adults. 2.5 on the grit scale is about 10%. If you score 2.5, you're gritty than only 10% of the adults in our sample. But if you scored 4.1, you're at the 70th percentile, grittier than about 70% of the adults in our sample. At 4.9, you're grittier than 99% of the American adults whom we surveyed. Keep in mind that your grit score is a reflection of how you see yourself right now. How gritty you are at this point in your life might be different from how gritty you were when you were younger. And if you take the grit scale again later, you might get a different score. As this book will continue to show, there is every reason to believe that grit can change. Grit has two components, passion and perseverance. If you want to dig a little deeper, you can calculate separate scores for each component. For your passion score, add up your points for the odd-numbered items and divide by 5. For your perseverance score, add up your points for the even-numbered items and divide by 5. If you scored high on passion, you probably scored high on perseverance too, and vice versa. Still, I'll take a guess that your perseverance score is a wee bit higher than your passion score. This isn't true for all people, but it's true for most people I've studied. For instance, I took the scale while writing this chapter, and I scored 4.6 overall. My perseverance score was 5.0, and my passion score was only 4.2. Strange as it sounds, staying focused on consistent goals over time is more of a struggle for me than working hard and bouncing back from setbacks. This consistent pattern, perseverance scores more often topping passion scores, is a clue that passion and perseverance aren't exactly the same thing. In the rest of this chapter, I'll explain how they differ and show how to understand them as two parts of a whole. While taking the grit scale, you might have noticed that none of the passion questions asked how intensely you're committed to your goals. This may seem odd, because the word passion is often used to describe intense emotions. For a lot of people, passion is synonymous with infatuation or obsession. But in interviews about what it takes to succeed, high achievers often talk about commitment of a different kind. Rather than intensity, what comes up again and again in their remarks is the idea of consistency over time. For instance, I've heard of chefs who grew up watching Julia Child on television and remained fascinated with cooking into adulthood. I've heard of investors whose curiosity about the financial markets is as keen in their fourth or fifth decade of investing as it was on their very first day of trading. I've heard of mathematicians who work on a problem, the same problem, day and night for years without once deciding, "Oh, to heck with this theorem, I'm moving on to something else." And that's why the questions that generate your passion score ask you to reflect on how steadily you hold to goals over time. Is passion the right word to describe sustained, enduring devotion? Some might say, I should find a better word. Maybe so. But the important thing is the idea itself. Enthusiasm is common. Endurance is rare. Consider, for example, Jeffrey Gettleman. For about a decade, Jeff has been the East Africa Bureau Chief for the New York Times. In 2012, he won the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting for his coverage of conflict in East Africa. He's a bit of a celebrity in the world of international journalism, widely admired for his courage to pursue stories that put his life at risk, and also for his willingness to unflinchingly report events that are unthinkably horrific. I met Jeff when we were in our early 20s. At the time, both of us were pursuing master's degrees at Oxford University. For me, this was before McKinsey, before teaching, and before becoming a psychologist. For Jeff, this was before he'd written his first news story. I think it's fair to say that, back then, neither of us knew quite what we wanted to be when we grew up, and we were both trying desperately to figure it out. I caught up with Jeff on the phone recently. He was in Nairobi, his home base between trips to other parts of Africa. Every few minutes, we had to ask each other if we could still be heard. After reminiscing about our classmates and trading news about our children, I asked Jeff to reflect on the idea of passion and how it had played out in his life. "For a very long time, I've had a very clear sense of where I wanted to be," Jeff told me, "and that passion is to live and work in East Africa." "Oh, I didn't know. I assumed your passion was journalism, not a certain area of the world. If you could only be a journalist or only live in East Africa, which would you choose?" I expected Jeff to pick journalism. He didn't. "Look, journalism is a great fit for me. I've always gravitated towards writing. I've always been okay being in new situations. Even the confrontational side of journalism, that speaks to my personality. I like to challenge authority. But I think journalism has been, in a sense, a means to an end. Jeff's passion emerged over a period of years. And it wasn't just a process of passive discovery, of unearthing a little gem hidden inside his psyche, but rather of active construction. Jeff didn't just go looking for his passion, he helped create it. Moving to Ithaca, New York from Evanston, Illinois, Jeff at 18 years old could not have predicted his future career. At Cornell, he ended up majoring in philosophy, in part because, quote, it was the easiest to fulfill the requirements, end quote. Then, the summer after freshman year, he visited East Africa, and that was the beginning of the beginning. Quote, I don't know how to explain it. This place just blew my mind. There was a spirit here that I wanted to connect with, and I wanted to make it a part of my life, unquote. As soon as he got back to Cornell, Jeff started taking courses in Swahili, and after sophomore year, he took a year off to backpack around the world. During that trip, he returned to East Africa, experiencing the same wonder he'd felt the first time he visited. Still, it wasn't clear how he'd make a life there. How did he hit on journalism as a career path? A professor who admired Jeff's writing suggested as much, and Jeff remembers thinking, "That's the dumbest idea I'd heard. Who wants to work for a boring newspaper?" I remember thinking the same thing once about becoming a professor. Who wants to be a boring professor? Eventually, Jeff did work for the student paper, the Cornell Daily Sun, but as a photographer, not a writer. When I got to Oxford, he told me, I was pretty lost academically. It was shocking to the Oxford professors that I didn't really know what I wanted to do. They were like, why are you here? This is a serious place. You should have a firm sense of what you want to study, or you shouldn't be here. My guess at the time was that Jeff would pursue photojournalism. He reminded me of Robert Kincaid, the worldly wise photographer played by Clint Eastwood in The Bridges of Madison County, which was released around the time we became friends. In fact, I can still remember the photographs Jeff showed me 20 years ago. I thought they were from National Geographic, but he'd actually taken them himself. By his second year at Oxford, he figured out that journalism was an even better fit. Once I learned more about being a journalist and how that could get me back to Africa, and how that actually would be fun, and I could write more creatively than I first imagined journalism was, then I was like, screw it, this is what I'm going to do. I set out a very deliberate path that was possible because the journalism industry was very hierarchical, and it was clear how to get from A to B to C to D, etc. Step A was writing for Oxford student newspaper, Cherwell. Step B was a summer internship at a small paper in Wisconsin. Step C was the St. Petersburg Times in Florida, on the Metro beat. Step D was the Los Angeles Times. Step E was the New York Times as a national correspondent in Atlanta. Step F was being sent overseas to cover war stories, and in 2006, just over a decade since he'd set himself the goal, he finally reached Step G, becoming the New York Times East Africa bureau chief. It was a really winding road that took me to all kinds of places, Jeff explained, and it was difficult and discouraging and demoralizing and scary and all the rest. But eventually, I got here. I got exactly where I wanted to be. As for so many other grit paragons, the common metaphor of passion as fireworks doesn't make sense when you think of what passion means to Jeff Gettleman. Fireworks erupt in a blaze of glory, but quickly fizzle, leaving just wisps of smoke and a memory of what was once spectacular. What Jeff's journey suggests instead is passion as a compass, that thing that takes you some time to build, tinker with, and finally get right, and that then guides you on your long, winding road to where ultimately you want to be. Seattle Seahawks coach Pete Carroll puts it this way. Do you have a life philosophy? For some of us, the question makes no sense. We might say, well, I have a lot of things I'm pursuing. a lot of goals, a lot of projects. Which do you mean? But others have no problem answering with conviction, this is what I want. Everything becomes a bit clearer when you understand the level of the goal Pete is asking about. He's not asking about what you want to get done today, specifically, or even this year. He's asking what you're trying to get out of life. In grit terms, he's asking about your passion. Pete's philosophy is, do things better than they have ever been done before. Like with Jeff, it took a while to figure out what, in the broader sense, he was aiming for. The pivotal moment came at a low point in his coaching career, just after getting fired as head coach of the New England Patriots. This was the first and only year in his life when Pete wasn't playing or coaching football. At that juncture, one of his good friends urged him to consider something more abstract than which job to take next. You've got to have a philosophy, his friend said. Pete realized he didn't have one and needed to. If I was ever going to get the chance to run an organization again, I would have to be prepared with a philosophy that would drive all my actions. Pete did a lot of thinking and reflecting. My life in the next few weeks and months was filled with writing notes and filling binders. At the same time, he was devouring the books of John Wooden, the legendary UCLA basketball coach who won a record-setting 10 national championships. Like a lot of coaches, Pete had already read Wooden, but this time he was reading Wooden and understanding at a much deeper level what the coaching icon had to say. And the most important thing Wooden said was that though a team has to do a million things well, figuring out the overarching vision is of utmost importance. Pete realized in that moment that particular goals, winning a particular game or even a seasonal championship or figuring out this element of the offensive lineup or the way to talk to players, needed coordination, needed purpose. A clear, well-defined philosophy, he said, gives you the guidelines and boundaries that keep you on track. One way to understand what Pete is talking about is to envision goals in a hierarchy. Imagine 10 circles organized into 3 rows in the shape of a pyramid. At the top of the pyramid is one big circle. That's our top-level goal. On the second row, there are 3 medium-sized circles. Those are our mid-level goals. On the bottom row of this hierarchy are 7 smaller circles. Those are our most concrete and specific goals, our low-level goals, the tasks we have on our short-term to-do list. I want to get out the door today by 8 a.m. I want to call my business partner back. I want to finish writing the email I started yesterday. These low-level goals exist merely as means to ends. We want to accomplish them only because they get us something else we want. In contrast, the higher the goal in this hierarchy, the more abstract, general, and important it is. The higher the goal, the more it's an end in itself, and the less it's merely a means to an end. In the diagram I've just described, there are just 3 levels. That's an oversimplification. Between the lowest and the highest level might be several layers of mid-level goals. For instance, getting out the door by 8 a.m. is a low-level goal. It only matters because of a mid-level goal, arriving at work on time. Why do you care about that? Because you want to be punctual. Why do you care about that? Because being punctual shows respect for the people with whom you work. Why is that important? Because you strive to be a good leader. If in the course of asking yourself these why questions, your answer is simply just because, then you know you've gotten to the top of a goal hierarchy. The top level goal is not a means to any other end. It is instead an end in itself. Some psychologists like to call this an ultimate concern. Myself, I think of this top level goal as a compass that gives direction and meaning to all the goals below it. Consider Hall of Fame pitcher Tom Seaver. When he retired in 1987 at the age of 42, he'd compiled 311 wins, 3,640 strikeouts, 61 shutouts, and a 2.86 earned run average. In 1992, when Seaver was elected to the Hall of Fame, he received the highest ever percentage of votes, 98.8%. During his 20-year professional baseball career, Seaver aimed to pitch, quote, the best I possibly can, day after day, year after year, unquote. Here is how that intention gave meaning and structure to all his lower order goals. Pitching determines what I eat, when I go to bed, what I do when I'm awake. It determines how I spend my life when I'm not pitching. If it means I have to come to Florida and can't get tanned because I might get a burn that would keep me from throwing for a few days, then I never go shirtless in the sun. If it means I have to remind myself to pet dogs with my left hand or throw logs on the fire with my left hand, then I do that too. If it means in the winter I eat cottage cheese instead of chocolate chip cookies in order to keep my weight down, then I eat cottage cheese. The life Seaver described sounds grim, but that's not how Seaver saw things. Pitching is what makes me happy. I've devoted my life to it. I've made up my mind what I want to do. I'm happy when I pitch well, so I only do things that help make me happy. What I mean by passion is not just that you have something you care about. What I mean is that you care about that same ultimate goal in an abiding, loyal, steady way. You are not capricious. Each day, you wake up thinking of the questions you fell asleep thinking about. You are, in a sense, pointing in the same direction, ever eager to take even the smallest step forward, then to take a step to the side, toward some other destination. At the extreme, one might call your focus obsessive. Most of your actions derive their significance from their allegiance to your ultimate concern, your life philosophy. You have your priorities in order. Grit is about holding the same top-level goal for a very long time. Furthermore, this life philosophy, as Pete Carroll might put it, is so interesting and important that it organizes a great deal of your waking activity. In very gritty people, most mid-level and low-level goals are in some way or another related to that ultimate goal. In contrast, a lack of grit can come from having less coherent goal structures. Here are a few ways a lack of grit can show itself. I've met many young people who can articulate a dream, for example, to be a doctor or to play basketball in the NBA, and can vividly imagine how wonderful that would be, but they can't point to the mid-level and lower-level goals that will get them there. Their goal hierarchy has a top-level goal, but no supporting mid-level or low-level goals. This is what my good friend and fellow psychologist Gabrielle Oettingen calls positive fantasizing. Gabrielle's research suggests that indulging in visions of a positive future without figuring out how to get there, chiefly by considering what obstacles stand in the way, has short-term payoffs but long-term costs. In the short term, you feel pretty great about your aspiration to be a doctor. In the long term, you live with the disappointment of not having achieved your goal. Even more common, I think, is having a bunch of mid-level goals that don't correspond to any unifying top-level goal, or having a few competing goal hierarchies that aren't in any way connected with each other. To some extent, goal conflict is a necessary feature of human existence. For instance, I have one goal hierarchy as a professional and another as a mother. Even Tom Seaver admits that the travel and practice schedule of a professional baseball player made it hard to spend as much time with his wife and children as he would have liked. So, though pitching was his professional passion, there were other goal hierarchies that obviously mattered to him. Like Seaver, I have one goal hierarchy for work. Use psychological science to help kids thrive. But I have a separate goal hierarchy that involves being the best mother I can be to my two daughters. As any working parent knows, having two ultimate concerns isn't easy. There seems never to be enough time, energy, or attention to go around. I've decided to live with that tension. As a young woman, I considered alternatives, not having my career or not raising a family, and decided that morally, there was no right decision, only a decision that was right for me. So the idea that every waking moment in our lives should be guided by one top-level goal is an idealized extreme that may not be desirable even for the grittiest of us. Still, I would argue that it's possible to pare down long lists of mid-level and low-level work goals according to how they serve a goal of supreme importance. And I think one top-level professional goal, rather than any other number, is ideal. In sum, the more unified, aligned, and coordinated our goal hierarchies, the better. Warren Buffett, the self-made multi-billionaire whose personal wealth acquired entirely within his own lifetime is roughly twice the size of Harvard University's endowment, reportedly gave his pilot a simple three-step process for prioritizing. The story goes like this. Buffett turns to his faithful pilot and says that he must have dreams greater than flying Buffett around to where he needs to go. The pilot confesses that, yes, he does. And then Buffett takes him through three steps. First, you write down a list of 25 career goals. Second, you do some soul searching and circle the five highest priority goals, just five. Third, you take a good hard look at the 20 goals you didn't circle. These you avoid at all costs. They're what distract you. They eat away time and energy, taking your eye from the goals that matter more. When I first heard this story, I thought, who could have as many as 25 different career goals? That's kind of ridiculous, isn't it? Then I started writing down on a piece of lined paper all the projects I'm currently working on. When I got to line 32, I realized that I could benefit from this exercise. Interestingly, most of the goals I spontaneously thought of were mid-level goals. People generally default to that level of goal when they're asked to write down a number of goals, not just one. To help me prioritize, I added columns that allowed me to sort out how interesting and important these projects were. I rated each goal on a scale from 1 to 10, from least to most interesting, and then again, from least to most important. I multiplied these numbers together to get a number from 1 to 100. None of my goals had an interest times importance rating as high as 100, but none were as low as 1 either. Then I tried to take Buffett's advice and circle just a few of the most interesting and important goals, relegating the rest to the avoid at all cost category. I tried, but I just couldn't do it. After a day or so of wondering who was right, me or Warren Buffett, I realized that a lot of my goals were, in fact, related to one another. The majority, in fact, were means to ends, setting me up to make progress toward one ultimate goal, helping kids achieve and thrive. There were only a few professional goals for which this wasn't true. Reluctantly, I decided to put those on the avoid at all cost list. Now, if I could ever sit down with Buffett and go through my list with him, which is unlikely since I doubt my needs rate a place in his goal hierarchy, he would surely tell me that the point of this exercise is to face the fact that time and energy are limited. Any successful person has to decide what to do in part by deciding what not to do. I get that, and I still have a ways to go on that count. But I would also say that conventional prioritizing isn't enough. When you have to divide your actions among a number of very different high-level career goals, you're extremely conflicted. You need one internal compass, not 2, 3, 4, or 5. So, to Buffett's three-step exercise in prioritizing, I would take an additional step. Ask yourself, to what extent do these goals serve a common purpose? The more they're part of the same goal hierarchy, important because they then serve the same ultimate concern, the more focused your passion. If you follow this method of prioritization, will you become a Hall of Fame pitcher or earn more money than anyone else in history? Probably not, but you'll stand a better chance of getting somewhere you care about, a better chance of moving closer to where you want to be. When you see your goals organized in a hierarchy, you realize that grit is not at all about stubbornly pursuing at all costs and ad infinitum, every single low-level goal on your list. In fact, you can expect to abandon a few of the goals you're working very hard on at this moment. Not all of them will work out. Sure, you should try hard, even a little longer than you might think necessary. But don't beat your head against the wall attempting to follow through on something that is, merely, a means to a more important end. I thought about how important it is to know how low-level goals fit into one's overall hierarchy when I listened to Roz Chast, the celebrated New Yorker cartoonist, give a talk at the local library. She told us her rejection rate is, at this stage in her career, about 90%. She claimed that it used to be much, much higher. I called Bob Mankoff, the cartoon editor for The New Yorker, to ask how typical that number is. To me, it seemed shockingly high. Bob told me that Roz was indeed an anomaly. Phew, I thought. I didn't want to think about all the cartoonists in the world getting rejected 9 times out of 10. But then Bob told me that most cartoonists live with even more rejection. At his magazine, contract cartoonists, who have dramatically better odds of getting published than anyone else, collectively submit about 500 cartoons every week. In a given issue, there is only room, on average, for about 17 of them. I did the math. That's a rejection rate of more than 96%. Holy smokes! Who would keep going when the odds are that grim? I asked. Well, for one, Bob himself. Bob's story reveals a lot about how dogged perseverance toward a top-level goal requires, paradoxically perhaps, some flexibility at lower levels in the goal hierarchy. It's as if the highest-level goal gets written in ink once you've done enough living and reflecting to know what that goal is, and the lower-level goals get written in pencil so you can revise them and sometimes erase them altogether and then figure out new ones to take their place. Imagine the goal hierarchy again. On the bottom level, one of the low-level goal circles has an angry-looking X through it. The goal has been blocked. It's a rejection slip, a setback, a dead end, a failure. The gritty person will be disappointed or even heartbroken, but not for long. Soon enough, the gritty person identifies a new low-level goal. One of the mottos of the Green Berets is, improvise, adapt, overcome. A lot of us were told as children, if at first you don't succeed, try, try again. Sound advice. But as they say, try, try again, then try something different. At lower levels of a goal hierarchy, that's exactly what's needed. Here's Bob Mankoff's story. Like Jeff Gettleman, the New York Times East Africa bureau chief, Bob didn't always have a clearly defined passion. As a child, Bob liked to draw, and instead of attending his local high school in the Bronx, he went to the LaGuardia High School of Music and Art, later fictionalized in the movie Fame. Once there, though, he got a look at the competition and was intimidated. Being exposed to real drawing talent, Bob recalls, made mine wither. I didn't touch a pen, pencil, or paintbrush for 3 years after graduating. Instead, he enrolled at Syracuse University, where he studied philosophy and psychology. In his senior year, he bought a book called Learning to Cartoon by the legendary Sid Hoff, an exemplar of the effort counts twice maxim. Over his lifetime, Hoff contributed 571 cartoons to The New Yorker, wrote and illustrated more than 60 children's books, drew 2 syndicated comic strips, and contributed literally thousands of drawings and cartoons to other publications. Hoff's book opens cheerily with, "Is it hard becoming a cartoonist? No, it isn't, and to prove it, I've written this book." It ends with a chapter called, "How to Survive Rejection Slips." In between are lessons on composition, perspective, the human figure, facial expressions, and so on. Bob used Hoff's advice to create 27 cartoons. He walked from one magazine to another, trying to make a sale, but not The New Yorker, which didn't see cartoonists in person. And he was, of course, summarily rejected by every editor he saw. Most asked him to try again with more cartoons the next week. More, Bob wondered. How could anyone do more than 27 cartoons? Before he could reread Hoff's last chapter on rejection slips, Bob received notice that he was eligible to be drafted for combat in Vietnam. He had no great desire to go, In fact, he had a great desire not to go. So, he repurposed himself, quickly, as a graduate student in experimental psychology. Over the next few years, while running rats in mazes, he found time, when he could, to draw. Then, just before earning his doctorate, he had the realization that research psychology wasn't his calling. I remember thinking that my defining personality characteristic was something else. I'm the funniest guy you've ever met. That's the way I thought of myself. I'm funny. For a while, Bob considered two ways of making humor his career. I said, okay, I'm going to do stand-up or I'm going to be a cartoonist. He threw himself into both with gusto. All day, I would write routines, and then at night, I would draw cartoons. But over time, one of these two mid-level goals became more attractive than the other. Stand-up was different back then, he told me. There weren't really comedy clubs. I'd have to go to the Borscht Belt, and I didn't really want to. I knew my humor was not going to work like I wanted it to for these people. So Bob dropped stand-up comedy and devoted his entire energy to cartoons. After 2 years of submitting, all I had to show for it were enough New Yorker rejection slips to wallpaper my bathroom, he said. There were small victories, cartoons sold to other magazines, but by that time, Bob's top-level goal had become a whole lot more specific and ambitious. He didn't just want to be funny for a living. He wanted to be among the best cartoonists in the world. The New Yorker was to cartooning what the New York Yankees were to baseball. The best team, Bob explains. If you could make that team, you too were one of the best. The piles of rejection slips suggested to Bob that try again was not working. He decided to do something different. I went to the New York Public Library and I looked up all the cartoons back to 1925 that had ever been printed in the New Yorker, he told me. At first, he thought maybe he didn't draw well enough. But it was plain to see that some very successful New Yorker cartoonists were third-rate draftsmen. Then Bob thought that something might be awry with the length of his captions, too short, too long, but that possibility wasn't supported either. Captions were generally brief, but not always, and anyway, Bob's didn't seem unusual in that respect. Then Bob thought maybe he was missing the mark with his type of humor. No, again. Some successful cartoonists were whimsical, some satirical, some philosophical, and some just interesting. The one thing all the cartoons had in common was this. They made the reader think. And here was another common thread. Every cartoonist had a personal style that was distinctively their own. There was no single best style. On the contrary, what mattered was that style was, in some very deep and idiosyncratic way, an expression of the individual cartoonist. Paging through, literally, every cartoon the New Yorker had ever published, Bob knew he could do as well, or better. I thought, I can do this. I can do this. I had complete confidence. He knew he could draw cartoons that would make people think, and he knew he could develop his own style. I worked through various styles, he told me. Eventually, I did my dot style. The now famous dot style of Bob's cartoons is called stippling, and Bob had originally tried it out back in high school when he discovered the French impressionist, Georges Seurat. After getting rejected from the New Yorker about 2,000 times between 1974 and 1977, Bob sent in another cartoon. It was accepted. You can see that cartoon on the PDF included with this audiobook. The next year, he sold 13 cartoons to the New Yorker, then 25 the following year, then 27. In 1981, Bob received a letter from the magazine asking if he'd consider becoming a contract cartoonist. He said yes. In his role as editor and mentor, Bob advises aspiring cartoonists to submit their drawings in batches of 10. Quote, because in cartooning, as in life, 9 out of 10 things never work out, unquote. Indeed, giving up on lower-level goals is not only forgivable, it's sometimes absolutely necessary. You should give up when one lower-level goal can be swapped for another that is more feasible. It also makes sense to switch your path when a different lower-level goal, a different means to the same end, is just more efficient or more fun, or for whatever reason, makes more sense than your original plan. On any long journey, detours are to be expected. However, the higher level the goal, the more it makes sense to be stubborn. Personally, I try not to get too hung up on a particular rejected grant application, academic paper, or failed experiment. The pain of those failures is real, but I don't dwell on them for long before moving on. In contrast, I don't give up as easily on mid-level goals, and frankly, I can't imagine anything that would change my ultimate aim, my life philosophy, as Pete might say. My compass, once I found all the parts and put it together, keeps pointing me in the same direction week after month after year. Long before I conducted the first interviews that put me on the trail of grit, a Stanford psychologist named Catherine Cox was herself cataloging the characteristics of high achievers. In 1926, Cox published her findings based on the biographical details of 301 exceptionally accomplished historical figures. These eminent individuals included poets, political and religious leaders, scientists, soldiers, philosophers, artists, and musicians. All lived and died in the four centuries prior to Cox's investigation, and all left behind records of accomplishment worthy of documentation in six popular encyclopedias. Cox's initial goal was to estimate how smart each of these individuals were, both relative to one another and also compared to the rest of humanity. In pursuing these estimates, she combed through the available evidence, searching for signs of intellectual precocity. And from the age and superiority of these accomplishments, she reckoned each person's childhood IQ. The published summary of this study, if you can call a book of more than 800 pages a summary, includes a case history for each of Cox's 301, arranged in order from least to most intelligent. According to Cox, the very smartest in the bunch was the philosopher John Stuart Mill, who earned an estimated childhood IQ score of 190 by learning Greek at age 3, writing a history of Rome at age 6, and assisting his father in correcting the proofs of a history of India at age 12. The least intelligent in Cox's ranking, whose estimated childhood IQs of 100 to 110 are just a hair above average for humanity, included the founder of modern astronomy, Nicholas Copernicus, the chemist and physicist Michael Faraday, and the Spanish poet and novelist Miguel de Cervantes. Isaac Newton ranks squarely in the middle, with an IQ of 130, the bare minimum that a child needs in order to qualify for many of today's gifted and talented programs. From these IQ estimates, Cox concluded that as a group, accomplished historical figures are smarter than most of us. No surprise there. A more unexpected observation was how little IQ mattered in distinguishing the most from the least accomplished. The average childhood IQ of the most eminent geniuses, whom Cox dubbed the first 10, was 146. The average IQ of the least eminent, dubbed the last 10, was 143. The spread was trivial. In other words, the relationship between intelligence and eminence in Cox's sample was exceedingly slight. Cox's first 10 most eminent geniuses were Sir Francis Bacon, Napoleon Bonaparte, Edmund Burke, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, Martin Luther, John Milton, Isaac Newton, William Pitt, Voltaire, and George Washington. Cox's last 10, the least eminent geniuses, Christian K.J. von Bunsen, Thomas Chalmers, Thomas Chatterton, Richard Cobden, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Georges J. Danton, Joseph Haydn, Hugues Félicité Robert de Lamennais, Giuseppe Mazzini, Joachim Murat. If intellectual talent wasn't the determinant of whether a person ascended to the first 10 or was relegated to the last 10, then what was? While poring over thousands of pages of biographical data, Cox and her assistant also evaluated 67 different personality traits for a subset of 100 geniuses. Cox deliberately chose a rainbow of traits. In fact, she covered the full range of what modern psychologists consider to be important, to allow for the fullest possible exploration of the differences that set apart the eminent from the rest of humanity, and further, the first 10 from the last 10. For most of the 67 indicators, Cox found only trivial differences between the eminent and the general population. For instance, eminence had little to do with extroversion, cheerfulness, or sense of humor. And not all the high achievers had earned high marks in school. Rather, what definitively set apart the eminent from the rest of humanity were a cluster of 4 indicators. Notably, these also distinguished the first 10 from the last 10, the supereminent from the merely eminent. Cox grouped these together and called them persistence of motive. 2 indicators could easily be rephrased as passion items for the grit scale. Degree to which he works with distant objects in view, as opposed to living from hand to mouth. Active preparation for later life, working toward a definite goal. And tendency not to abandon tasks for mere changeability. Not seeking something fresh because of novelty. Not looking for a change. And the other 2 could easily be rewritten as perseverance items for the grit scale. Degree of strength of will or perseverance, quiet determination to stick to a course once decided upon, and tendency not to abandon tasks in the face of obstacles, perseverance, tenacity, doggedness. In her summary comments, Cox concluded that, quote, high but not the highest intelligence, combined with the greatest degree of persistence, will achieve greater eminence than the highest degree of intelligence with somewhat less persistence, end quote. However you scored on the grit scale, I hope it prompted self-reflection. It's progress just clarifying your goals and the extent to which they are, or aren't, aligned toward a single passion of supreme importance. It's also progress to better understand how well you're currently able to persevere in the face of life's rejection slips. It's a start. Let's continue in the next chapter to see how grit can and does change. And then, in the rest of this audiobook, let's learn how to accelerate that growth. Chapter 5. Grit Grows. How much of our grit is in our genes? I'm asked some version of this question pretty much any time I give a talk on grit. The nature-nurture question is a very basic one. We have an intuitive sense that some things about us, like our height, are pretty much determined in the genetic lottery, while other things, like whether we speak English or French, are a result of our upbringing and experience. You can't train height is a popular expression in basketball coaching, and many people who learn about grit want to know if it's more like height or more like language. To the question of whether we get grit from our DNA, there's a short answer and a long one. The short answer is, in part. The long answer is, well, more complicated. In my view, the longer answer is worth our attention. Science has made huge strides in figuring out how genes, experience, and their interplay make us who we are. From what I can tell, the inherent complexity of these scientific facts has led, unfortunately, to their continually being misunderstood. To begin, I can tell you with complete conviction that every human trait is influenced by both genes and experience. Consider height. Height is indeed heritable. Genetic differences are a big reason why some people are really tall, some really short, and a bunch of people of varying heights in between. But it's also true that the average height of men and women has increased dramatically in just a few generations. For instance, military records show that the average British man was 5 feet 5 inches tall about 150 years ago. But today that average is 5 feet 10 inches. Height gains have been even more dramatic in other countries. In the Netherlands, the average man now stands almost 6 foot 1, a gain of more than 6 inches over the last 150 years. I'm reminded of these dramatic generational gains in height whenever I get together with my Dutch collaborators. They bend down solicitously, but it still feels like standing in a forest of redwoods. It's unlikely that the gene pool has changed all that dramatically in just a few generations. Instead, the most powerful height boosters have been nutrition, clean air and water, and modern medicine. Incidentally, generational gains in weight have been even more dramatic, and again, that seems to be the consequence of eating more and moving around less, rather than changes in our DNA. Even within a generation, you can see the influence of environment on height. Children who are provided healthy food in abundance will grow up taller, whereas malnourishment stunts growth. Likewise, traits like honesty and generosity and, yes, grit, are genetically influenced, and in addition, influenced by experience. Ditto for IQ, extroversion, enjoying the great outdoors, having a sweet tooth, the likelihood that you'll end up a chain smoker, your risk of getting skin cancer, and really any other trait you can think of. Nature matters, and so does nurture. Talents, in all their varieties, are also genetically influenced. Some of us are born with genes that make it easier to learn to carry a tune, or dunk a basketball, or solve a quadratic equation. But against intuition, talents are not entirely genetic. The rate at which we develop any skill is also, crucially, a function of experience. For instance, sociologist Dan Chambliss swam competitively in high school, but stopped when it seemed clear he wasn't going to make it as a nationally ranked swimmer. "I'm small," he explained to me, "and my ankles won't plantar flex." "Come again?" "Oh, I can't point my toes, I can only flex them. It's an anatomical limitation, which means, basically, at the elite level, I could only swim breaststroke." After our exchange, I did a little research on plantar flexion. Stretching exercises can improve your range of motion, but the length of certain bones does make a difference in how flexible your feet and ankles are. Still, the biggest impediment to improving wasn't anatomy. It was how he was coached. "In retrospect," he told me, "I look back now and can see I had horribly bad coaches in a couple of crucial places. One of my high school coaches, I had him for 4 years, literally taught me zero, nothing. He taught me how to do a breaststroke turn, and he taught me incorrectly." What happened when Dan did finally experience good coaching, in part from hanging around the national and Olympic coaches he was studying? "Years later," he said, "I got back into the pool, got in shape again, and swam a 200-yard individual medley as fast as I did in high school." Again, same story. Not just nature, and not just nurture. Both. How do scientists know, with unwavering conviction, that both nature and nurture play a role in determining things like talent and grit? Over the past few decades, researchers have been studying identical and fraternal twins, raised in the same family or raised in different families. Identical twins have all the same DNA, while fraternal twins, on average, only share about half. That fact, and a whole lot of fancy statistics, well, not that fancy, more mundane really once a good teacher explains them to you, allows researchers to infer, from how similar the twins grow up to be, the heritability of a trait. Very recently, researchers in London let me know they'd administered the grit scale to more than 2,000 pairs of teenage twins living in the United Kingdom. This study estimated the heritability of the perseverance subscale to be 37% and the passion subscale to be 20%. These estimates are on par for heritability estimates for other personality traits, and in the simplest terms, this means that some of the variation in grit in the population can be attributed to genetic factors, and the rest can be attributed to experience. I hasten to add that there isn't just one gene that explains the heritability of grit. On the contrary, dozens of research studies have shown that almost all human traits are polygenic, meaning that traits are influenced by more than one gene. Many more, in fact. Height, for example, is influenced by, at last count, at least 697 different genes. And some of the genes that influence height influence other traits as well. In total, the human genome contains as many as 25,000 different genes, and they tend to interact with one another and with environmental influences in complicated, still poorly understood ways. In sum, what have we learned? First, grit, talent, and all other psychological traits relevant to success in life are influenced by genes and also by experience. Second, there is no single gene for grit, or indeed any other psychological trait. I'd like to make a third important point. Heritability estimates explain why people differ from the average, but they say nothing about the average itself. While the heritability of height says something about variability, why in a given population some people are taller and some shorter, it says nothing about how average height has changed. This is important because it provides evidence that the environment we grow up in really does matter, and it matters a lot. Here's another striking example, and one more relevant to the science of success, the Flynn effect. Named after Jim Flynn, the New Zealand social scientist who discovered it, the Flynn effect refers to startling gains in IQ scores over the past century. How big are the gains? On the most widely used IQ tests today, the Wechsler Intelligence Scale for Children and the Wechsler Adult Intelligence Scale, gains have averaged more than 15 points in the last 50 years in the more than 30 countries that have been studied. Put another way, if you scored people a century ago against modern norms, they would have an average IQ score of 70, borderline for mentally retarded. If you scored people today against the norms of a century ago, we would have an average IQ score of 130, the typical cut score for mentally gifted programs. When I first learned about the Flynn effect, I didn't believe it. How could it be that we're all getting that much smarter so quickly? I called Jim to share my incredulity and my desire to learn more. Globetrotter that he is, he actually flew all the way to Philadelphia to meet with me and give a talk on his work. At our first encounter, I remember thinking that Jim looked like a caricature of an academic, tall, a little bony, wire-rimmed glasses, and a rather unruly head of curly steel gray hair. Flynn began his talk with the basic facts on IQ change. Digging through the raw scores of IQ tests taken over the years, he found that the improvements on some tests were much bigger than others. He went to the chalkboard and sketched out a steep line indicating that scores had climbed most sharply for IQ tests assessing abstract reasoning. For instance, many young children today can answer the question, "Dogs and rabbits, how are they alike?" They might tell you that both dogs and rabbits are alive, or that they're both animals. In the scoring manual, these answers only earn half credit. Some children might go so far as to say that they're both mammals, and for that insight, they'd earn full credit. In contrast, young children a century ago might look at you quizzically and say, "Dogs chase rabbits," 0 points. As a species, we're getting better and better at abstract reasoning. By way of explaining massive gains in certain IQ subtests, but not in others, Flynn told a story about basketball and television. Basketball, at all levels of competition, has gotten more competitive over the last century. Flynn played a little ball himself as a student and remembers the game changing even within a few years. What happened? According to Flynn, what happened was television. Basketball was a great game to watch on the small screen, and the exposure fueled the game's popularity. Once television became a household fixture, more kids started playing the game, trying left-handed layups, crossover dribbles, graceful hook shots, and other skills that seemed routine among star players. And by getting better, each kid inadvertently enriched the learning environment for the kids he or she was playing against. Because one thing that makes you better at basketball is playing with kids who are just a little more skilled. Flynn called this virtuous cycle of skill improvement the social multiplier effect, and he used the same logic to explain generational changes in abstract reasoning. More and more over the past century, our jobs and daily lives ask us to think analytically, logically. We go to school for longer, and in school we're asked, more and more, to reason rather than rely on rote memorization. Either small environmental differences or genetic ones can trigger a virtuous cycle. Either way, the effects are multiplied socially through culture because each of us enriches the environment of all of us. To see a graph showing how grit scale scores vary by age, please refer to the PDF included with this audiobook. The data are from a large sample of American adults, and you can see from the horizontal axis that the grittiest adults in my sample were in their late 60s or older. The least gritty were in their 20s. One explanation for this data is that there's a sort of reverse Flynn effect for grit. For instance, it's possible that adults in their seventh decade of life are grittier because they grew up in a very different cultural era, perhaps one whose values and norms emphasized sustained passion and perseverance more than has been the case recently. In other words, it could be that the greatest generation is grittier than the millennials because cultural forces are different today than yesterday. This explanation for why grit and age go hand in hand was suggested to me by an older colleague who, looking over my shoulder at the same graph, shook his head and said, "I knew it. I've been teaching the same undergraduates the same course at the same university for decades, and I'll tell you, they just don't work as hard these days as they used to." My dad, who gave his entire professional life as a chemist to DuPont, and quite literally retired with the gold watch, might say the same of the Wharton entrepreneur who approached me after my lecture. Even while pulling all-nighters for his present venture, the young man half expected to be onto something entirely new within a few years. Alternatively, it's possible these age trends have nothing to do with generational changes in grit. Instead, what the data may be showing is how people mature over time. My own experience, and the stories of grit paragons like Jeff Gettleman and Bob Mankoff, suggests that, indeed, grit grows as we figure out our life philosophy, learn to dust ourselves off after rejection and disappointment, and learn to tell the difference between low-level goals that should be abandoned quickly and higher-level goals that demand more tenacity. The maturation story is that we develop the capacity for long-term passion and perseverance as we get older. To distinguish between these rival explanations, we need a different kind of study. To generate the data I just showed you, I asked people of different ages about their current level of grit. What I got was a snapshot of grit in younger and older adults. Ideally, I'd follow these people for the rest of their lives, the way psychologist George Valiant followed the Harvard men. Since the grit scale hasn't been around very long, I can't play you a time-lapse movie of grit over the life course. What I want is that movie. What I have is a snapshot. Fortunately, many other aspects of personality have been examined longitudinally. In dozens of studies that have followed people over years and decades, the trends are clear. Most of us become more conscientious, confident, caring, and calm with life experience. A lot of that change happens between the ages of 20 and 40. But in fact, there's no epoch in the human lifespan where personality stops evolving. Collectively, these data demonstrate what personality psychologists now call the maturity principle. We grow up, or at least most of us do. To some extent, these changes are pre-programmed and biological. Puberty and menopause are things that change our personalities, for example. But on the whole, personality change is more a function of life experience. Exactly how do life experiences change personality? One reason we change is that we learn something we simply didn't know before. For instance, we might learn through trial and error that repeatedly swapping out one career ambition for another is unfulfilling. That's certainly what happened to me in my 20s. After running a nonprofit, then pursuing neuroscience research, then management consulting, then teaching, I learned that being a promising beginner is fun, but being an actual expert is infinitely more gratifying. I also learned that years of hard work are often mistaken for innate talent, and that passion is as necessary as perseverance to world-class excellence. Likewise, we learn, as novelist John Irving did, that to do anything really well, you have to overextend yourself, to appreciate that in doing something over and over again, something that was never natural becomes almost second nature. And finally, that the capacity to do work that diligently doesn't come overnight. Other than insights about the human condition, what else is there that changes with age? What changes, I think, are our circumstances. As we grow older, we're thrust into new situations. We get our first job. We may get married. Our parents get older, and we find ourselves their caretakers. Often, these new situations call on us to act differently than we used to. And because there's no species on the planet more adaptable than ours, we change. We rise to the occasion. In other words, we change when we need to. Necessity is the mother of adaptation. Here's a trivial example. Somehow, my youngest daughter, Lucy, reached the age of 3 without learning to use the potty. My husband and I had done our best to bribe, cajole, and trick her into leaving diapers behind. We'd read all the books about all the right things to do, and we tried to do all those things. Or at least we tried as energetically as is possible for working parents with other things on their to-do lists. To no avail. Lucy's will proved stronger than ours. Soon after her 3rd birthday, Lucy changed preschool classrooms, from the toddler classroom, where almost all the children were still in diapers, to the big kid classroom, which didn't even have a changing table. The first day I dropped her off in the new room, her eyes widened to saucers, scanning this new environment, a little bit afraid, I think, and more likely than not wishing she could stay in her old room, where she'd grown comfortable. I'll never forget picking Lucy up that afternoon. She smiled at me proudly and announced she'd use the potty. And then, in so many words, she told me she was done with diapers. And she was. Potty training happened in a single moment in time. How? Because when a child lines up for the potty with all the other children and sees that she's expected to take her turn, she does exactly that. She learns to do what she needs to do. Bernie Noe, the headmaster of the Lakeside School in Seattle, recently shared this story about his own daughter. It illustrates the maturity principle to a T. Noe's family lives on campus, and as a teenager, his daughter was late to school almost every day. One summer, his daughter got a job folding clothes at the local American Eagle. On her first day, the store manager said, "Oh, by the way, the first time you're late, you're fired." She was stunned. No second chances. All her life, there'd been patience, understanding, and second chances. So then what happened? It was amazing, Noe remembered. Quite literally, it was the most immediate behavior change I've ever seen her make. Suddenly, his daughter was setting 2 alarms to make sure she was on time, or early, to a job where being late was simply not tolerated. As a headmaster tasked with shepherding young people toward maturity, Noe considers his power to do so somewhat limited. "If you're a business, you don't care whether a kid thinks they're special," he told me. "What you care about is, can you deliver? If you can't deliver, hey, we don't have any use for you. Lectures don't have half the effect of consequences." What the maturity principle comes down to, I think, is this. Over time, we learn life lessons we don't forget, and we adapt in response to the growing demands of our circumstances. Eventually, new ways of thinking and acting become habitual. There comes a day when we can hardly remember our immature former selves. We've adapted. Those adaptations have become durable. And finally, our identity, the sort of person we see ourselves to be, has evolved. We've matured. Taken together, the data I've collected on grit and age are consistent with two different stories. One story says that our grit changes as a function of the cultural era in which we grew up. The other story says that we get grittier as we get older. Both could be true, and I have a suspicion that both are, at least to an extent. Either way, this snapshot reveals that grit is not entirely fixed. Like every aspect of your psychological character, grit is more plastic than you might think. If grit can grow, how does that happen? I get emails and letters almost every day from people who wish they had more grit. They lament that they never stuck with anything in order to get really good at it. They feel they've squandered their talents. They desperately want a long-term goal, and they want to pursue that goal with passion and perseverance, but they don't know where to begin. A good place to start is to understand where you are today. If you're not as gritty as you want to be, ask yourself why. The most obvious answer people come up with goes something like this: I guess I'm just lazy. Here's another: I'm just a flake. Or, I'm congenitally incapable of sticking with things. All of these answers, I think, are wrong. In fact, when people drop out of things, they do so for a reason. Actually, they do so for different reasons. Any of these four thoughts might go through your head right before you quit what you're doing. I'm bored. The effort isn't worth it. This isn't important to me. I can't do this, so I may as well give up. There's nothing wrong, morally or otherwise, with thoughts like these. As I tried to show in this chapter, paragons of grit quit goals too. But the higher the level of the goal in question, the more stubborn they are about seeing it through. Most important, paragons of grit don't swap compasses. When it comes to the one singularly important aim that guides almost everything else they do, the very gritty tend not to utter these statements. A lot of what I've learned about how grit grows comes from interviewing men and women who epitomize the qualities of passion and perseverance. I've included snippets of those conversations throughout this book, so that you too can peer inside the mind and heart of a grit paragon and see whether there's a belief, attitude, or habit worth emulating. These stories of grit are one kind of data, and they complement the more systematic, quantitative studies I've done in places like West Point and the National Spelling Bee. Together, the research reveals the psychological assets that mature paragons of grit have in common. There are four. They counter each of the buzzkillers I described a moment ago, and they tend to develop, over the years, in a particular order. First comes interest. Passion begins with intrinsically enjoying what you do. Every gritty person I've studied can point to aspects of their work they enjoy less than others, and most have to put up with at least one or two chores they don't enjoy at all. Nevertheless, they're captivated by the endeavor as a whole, and they find it meaningful. With enduring fascination and childlike curiosity, they practically shout out, "I love what I do." Next comes the capacity to practice. One form of perseverance is the daily discipline of trying to do things better than we did yesterday. So, after you've discovered and developed interest in a particular area, you must devote yourself to the sort of focused, full-hearted, challenge-exceeding skill practice that leads to mastery. You must zero in on your weaknesses, and you must do so over and over again, for hours a day, week after month after year. To be gritty is to resist complacency. "Whatever it takes, I want to improve," is a refrain of all paragons of grit, no matter their particular interest, and no matter how excellent they already are. Third is purpose. What ripens passion is the conviction that your work matters. For most people, interest without purpose is nearly impossible to sustain for a lifetime. It is therefore imperative that you identify your work as both personally interesting and, at the same time, integrally connected to the well-being of others. For a few, a sense of purpose dawns early, but for many, the motivation to serve others heightens after the development of interest and years of disciplined practice. Regardless, fully mature exemplars of grit invariably tell me, "My work is important, both to me and to others." And finally, hope. Hope is a rising to the occasion kind of perseverance. In this book, I discuss it after interest, practice, and purpose. But hope does not define the last stage of grit. It defines every stage. From the very beginning to the very end, it is inestimably important to learn to keep going even when things are difficult, even when we have doubts. At various points in big ways and small, we get knocked down. If we stay down, grit loses. If we get up, grit prevails. Without the meddling of a psychologist like me, you may have figured grit out all on your own. You may already have a deep and abiding interest, a ready appetite for constant challenge, an evolved sense of purpose, and buoyant confidence in your ability to keep going that no adversity could sink. If so, you're probably close to 5 out of 5 on the grit scale. I applaud you. If, on the other hand, you're not as gritty as you wish you were, then there's something for you in the chapters that follow. Like calculus and piano, you can learn the psychology of grit on your own, but a little guidance can be a tremendous help. The 4 psychological assets of interest, practice, purpose, and hope are not you have it or you don't commodities. You can learn to discover, develop, and deepen your interests. You can acquire the habit of discipline. You can cultivate a sense of purpose and meaning. And you can teach yourself to hope. You can grow your grit from the inside out. If you'd like to know how, keep listening.